All right, so I think it might have been, I'm trying to remember if it was this group where maybe it was at the lake trip we got talking about the preamble to the Constitution. Does this sound familiar to anybody? Maybe it was a different group of people. Somebody had the preamble memorized. Anybody in this room?
Dr. Jenkins?
No? Okay. Anyway, I guess I had that wrong. Preamble of the Constitution, I don't actually have it memorized, but what's the most famous part, right? We hold what?
These truths.
We still
have it.
Yeah?
Amen.
That they are endowed by the Creator with? Among these are? Right. So why do you guys know that?
No idea.
No idea, exactly, right? What's that?
Will Smith
movies. Interesting. Your history teacher would be proud, I'm sure. So this is like something that's just in our culture, right? This is one of the foundational ideas that we as a country and we as a culture hold to. This idea that people are equal, that there are certain rights that we have that are inalienable, that can't be violated. And so among those, and kind of if we were to summarize this idea, we'd summarize it with the idea of freedom, right? We are a country that believes in freedom. We are a culture that believes in freedom. We sang songs about freedom. And so this whole concept of being free is something that resonates with us. It's what we want. When we perceive we are not free or someone has taken away our freedom, we get mad, right? And we fight back, and we try and take our freedom. We like to be free. This is like really deeply ingrained in us as a culture, but I think it's pretty deeply ingrained in people everywhere in all time, that freedom is something to be cherished. And when freedom is taken away by oppressive people or by governments or by people that would victimize others, that is a particularly bad thing, right? That's kind of a crime that needs to be stopped. So in light of that, let me give a little plug for 2 weeks from now. We are going to have a speaker come to YAF on Thursday night from International Justice Mission. That is a great Christian organization that works to basically bring freedom to all sorts of people. So they do some really cool work. I've visited with one of their offices in India, heard some of the stories they do there. So we're going to have a speaker come on Thursday night and just kind of we're going to give her the night and have her share a little bit about the organization. A couple people from the church, one of our guys is on the board of IJM, one of our people that grew up the church works there in one of their kind of training departments. And so we're excited about this, and I think you should be too. A lot of you probably already know about it. It's a pretty cool organization. But one of the things they do is they go and they rescue people and they give them freedom. And the other cool thing about them is they don't just rescue the oppressed people, but they punish the bad guys. So that's kind of fun about IJM too. But as it relates to tonight we're looking at Galatians. We're in the middle of this series as a group we've called Belonging in Grace. And we're looking at the book of Galatians, and we're trying particularly to understand how this book shapes us as a community, how it creates these horizontal relationships, how the gospel draws a group together and forms some type of community within the group. And the thing we're going to be seeing tonight about the community is that one of the characteristics of a community the gospel creates is that it's free. It is a community of freedom. And I think that is something that is incredibly appealing to everybody, but also elusive. It's hard to really be in a place where you feel free to be yourself, to interact, to do all the things that we want to do. So we're going to look at how that works tonight. We're looking at Galatians 4, which is a long chapter. And so we're just going to look at the first part of it. We're going to look at Galatians 4, 1 to 10. Basically, the way this chapter plays out is there's these ideas in the beginning, Galatians 4, 1 to 10, and we're going to really look at those ideas tonight and try and wrap our minds around those. And then Paul goes into this personal appeal based on his relationship with the Galatian churches as a way of emphasizing those ideas. And then he talks about this, he gives kind of an illustration, you know, like I might show a movie clip. Paul talks about Hagar and Sarah. But like, I don't get it. So we're not going to talk about that part of this chapter. That's the advantage of being up here. I get to decide that I don't want to talk about the things I don't understand. So 4, 1 to 10, That's a little easier to grasp. We're going to stay there. Sound good? All right, so let me read it, and then we're going to kind of walk through this in a couple different sections. Galatians 4, 1 to 10. So let me back up, actually. He has just said to the Galatians, he's had this grand statement about being one and about all the distinctions that might characterize them falling away. And his conclusion in verse 29 of chapter 3 is that if you are Christ's, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to the promise. And so he's given this idea that if you have faith in Christ, you inherit something. There's something that is yours, some privilege that you get. And he's going to explain that. 4 verse 1. I mean that the heir, as long as he is a child, is no different from a slave, though he is the owner of everything. But he is under guardians and managers until the date set by his father. In the same way, we also, when we were children, were enslaved to the elementary principles of the world. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. And because you are sons, God has sent the Spirit of his son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. So you are no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then an heir through God. Formerly, when you did not know God, you were enslaved to those that by nature are not gods. But now that you have come to know God, or rather, to be known by God, how can you turn back again to the weak and worthless elementary principles of the world, whose slaves you want to be once more? You observe days and months and seasons and years. I'm afraid I may have labored over you in vain. So what Paul does in these verses is he describes a progression that the gospel creates when you believe in Jesus. And this progression begins with the pre-existing state of essentially being slaves. He says when you're a child, you're treated as a slave. And he talks about prior to faith, prior to the power of the gospel, we were enslaved. So we're going to talk a little bit about what it looks like, this slavery that he's describing. But then he said something happens because of the gospel, and that's something he calls redemption. And so you begin as a slave, and then there's this process of redemption, and that's what we're going to spend some time on, thinking about what does it mean to be redeemed. And the result of that, then, the consequence, he describes as adoption, and particularly as adoption as sons. And so we, through faith in Jesus, become adopted as sons of God. And then the final idea is that he gives a warning. He says, this is what has happened. You were slaves. You have been redeemed. You are adopted. But he warns them, you can mess it up. You can act like it's not true. You can live like you used to live. Don't do that. And so that's kind of the last place we're going to end. So we're going to track this process from slavery through redemption to adoption and culminating in this warning. So let's start by thinking about slavery and what Paul describes. What do you think of when you think of slavery? What are words to describe that?
Chains.
Chains, yeah, good. Masters. What else?
Well, like today, like the sex slave
chain. Sex slave, sure, yeah.
Oppression.
Abuse.
Anything else?
Lack of freedom.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, this is like one of the worst things. I mean, to be forced to do something against your will, and if it's labor, not to be compensated for it. You're just a machine, right? I mean, to be a slave means that you have no choice. Right? That's one of the first aspects of slavery. You don't choose what you get to do. And that's one of the essential parts about being human, is that we have free will. We have choice. We can decide things. But when you are a slave, your choice is taken away from you. You have no inherent value as a person. Your personhood is destroyed. And all you have is what you can offer or produce. So if it's a sex trade, then you are a sexual object. If you're in bonded slavery, we'll probably hear a lot about that from IJM, then all you have is what you can produce in terms of labor. You don't matter. Your individuality is gone. All that matters is what you can do. And you're constantly evaluated. You're constantly priced. You're constantly oppressed. You are probably beaten and abused. And so, really, to be a slave means that, like, most of the things that we consider just baseline for being human are taken away. And so when Paul describes this imagery, it's strong imagery. It's powerful to say, we once, when you did not know God, you were enslaved. You were slaves. You had no choice. You had no value. You were evaluated. You were oppressed. You were abused. These are the things he's saying. And what he says here is really he's talking about slavery in two categories. And this is helpful for us to think about. First of all, he talks about us who were under the law. So in verse 3, he says, when we were children, we were enslaved to the elementary principles of the world. That we, he's talking about, is inclusive of Jews. And so he's talking about Jews, and he's saying we were enslaved to the law, essentially. Again, in verse 5, he says, God sent his son to redeem those who were under the law. And so there's that same idea. And this is one way that people find themselves living as slaves. And the sad part about this is that this can very commonly be experienced by Christians within the Christian community. And I would describe this as being slaves to rules, slavery by rules. This is what he's describing. It's essentially religious slavery. And this is the dark side of religion. It's why a lot of people in our culture are skeptical of religion. And there's a lot of good reasons for people to be skeptical of religion, because it's possible to treat religion in a way that enslaves you to it. You have no choice. You simply do what you're told to do. You have no value. All your value is based on how you perform. You have no individuality. There's abuse and oppression based on lack of performance. We load ourselves up with shame and guilt. I mean, this is why Paul describes this as slavery. It is easy to be enslaved to rules. And some of you probably grew up in Christian homes. And I think for anybody that grows up in a Christian home, there's often a process of experiencing this on some level and realizing that real faith is not that. That there is some distinction, that faith in Christ is not slavery, but it's freedom. But that can be tricky because it's often first experienced as slavery. I grew up in a church, and I remember as a kid thinking, like, I don't know, you know, it kind of sounded like it was probably true to me as a kid, but I wasn't sure I wanted to believe. I wasn't sure I wanted to live like that. And a lot of the reasons were the rules. I was like, well, I don't really know if I want to wait to have sex until I'm married. I don't really know if I would want to not do these things. I don't know if I want to feel guilty if I do some other stuff. Like, I'm not sure the rules are things that I want to live by. And I don't want to be enslaved by them. And so I kind of remember as a kid thinking, I'm going to just wait and see how this thing plays out. And then God was faithful and changed my mind and brought me to a place where I received it as something other than slavery to rules. But this is one type of slavery Paul's talking about, that it is possible to be enslaved under the law. But then there's a second type, and that is the, if you didn't grow up in a Christian home, or people that have no faith or have no experience with religion, he says that is a type of slavery as well. And so he describes other people that are enslaved to those that by nature are not gods. He describes, in a different sense, the elementary principles of the world, weak and worthless. And so this is what I would describe as slavery to desires, right? And so if you grew up in a system where there is kind of nothing to say this is good and this is bad, there is no sense of morality or ethics, what do? You do what you want to do, right? You're essentially a slave to your desire. There's no reason not to do the things I want to do, get the things I want to get. If I want to be rich, then I'll do what it takes to be rich. If I want to be this, I'll do what it takes to be that. And so this is the other side of the coin. If one side we can be enslaved by rules, and another side we can be enslaved by our desires. And we can simply do what comes naturally and do it because it feels good and I want to, and there's nothing standing in our way. But that is also a kind of slavery. Because what you discover, if you're honest, is that you don't get what you want when you do that. Things that you want aren't actually what you want. Because what you want is to be valued. What you want is to be loved. And those are things that can't come when you're totally consumed with self. And so Paul describes this slavery, and he says that this is what was. This is the process that we began with. And this is helpful for us because whether you grew up in the church, or you didn't grow up, whether you have faith now, or you don't have faith now, or you're exploring, wherever you find yourself, I think we have experienced this type of slavery. I know I have. I've experienced times where I wanted to live a certain way and I simply couldn't. I felt like I had no choice but to follow my desires. I've lived in times where I've been in communities where the rules were so strict and the system so tight that I had no choice because everything was spelled out for me. And so this is the pre-existing state that Paul describes. He describes it as slavery. And I'd like to invite you to think about that. Like, how have you experienced that in your life? How have you experienced, what does being enslaved, having no choice, having no value, what types of things have you been enslaved to? Have you been caught up in? Have you felt like you haven't been able to control or keep in check? These are the ways that God speaks to us. These are the touch points that the gospel has in our experience. So, the pre-existing state is this tension, right? There's slavery to rules or there's slavery to desires. And this is why grace and freedom become the central message of the gospel in Galatians. Because you can live in a community that's run by rules, and you have to follow these rules or you're not allowed. You have to follow these rules or you're an outcast. You can also live in a community that's just ruled by desires, and people just do what they want, and nobody cares about people. And if I happen to enjoy you, I'll be nice to you. But if I stop enjoying you, I'll stop being nice to you. And there's communities like that. But grace is the one thing that manages to regulate our behavior, that manages to help us to see outside of ourselves without enslaving us to rules. It's this incredible thing that the gospel offers. And this is what Paul's going to explain. How do we get grace? How do we get from being a slave on either side to being free in the middle? So the process he describes that is what he calls redemption. He says, you have been redeemed. And in using that terminology, he's staying with the same imagery that he's using when he talks about slavery. So the redemption imagery is one of the slave market. The idea is that you have been purchased, you have been bought for a price, and you now belong to someone else. And so he says that, he says in the fullness of time that we have been redeemed because God sent forth his Son to redeem those under the law. And so the idea then is this sending his Son is essentially the cost, the price. This is what he has paid in order to buy us. And this is important for us to realize because we have to understand the value that we have before God, that he would spend so much for our sakes. And I think that we probably, when we're honest, a lot of times think, you know, God probably like got gypped when he bought me. Right? Like, he spent way too much on me. He got fooled by the salesman, and he probably regrets it. Because that's often how we feel, right? Maybe it was 2 years ago, one of my sons really wanted this Lego thing that cost like $70, right? Which is like an enormous amount of money if you're seven, right? So we have a rule in our house, if you be the dishwasher, you get paid 50 cents. And you can like do chores for 50 cents. So he like worked hard to like earn up $70, and he saved his birthday money, which was like $5. You know, I mean, he's like collecting money to buy this $70 Lego set. And he had enough and he bought it. And the next day I was like, what do you think? And he's like, yeah, it's cool, I guess. You know, meh. Like, work so hard, and you save up all your money, and then you buy it, and you're like, it's really not as much as I thought it would be, right? And I think we have that experience all the time, because we think that something's going to be great, so we spend as much as we can on it, and then we realize it's really not all that. And so I think a lot of times we project that on God, and it's like, yeah, God paid a lot for us, but now he's like, dang it, why did I do that, right? This person wasn't worth it. But that's not what's true. And what's remarkable, and this is kind of the foundation of grace, is that, you know, my son thought that this Lego set was going to be something. And he saved up his money and he bought it. And in some sense, he was wrong. In some sense, it didn't give him the satisfaction he wanted. What's incredible about God is that God knows us. It's not like buying a used car where you, like, get it home and you realize, oh, there's all this stuff wrong that I didn't know about. God knows us before he paid the price. He knew what we were like. He knew what he was getting when he redeemed us. And he still did it. And that's really, I think, the remarkable thing about understanding what it means that God has redeemed us. The idea that he knows us fully and accepts us completely. That's grace. That God knows us fully and accepts us completely. And that is a powerful thing. I think that really, if you get down to what we want as people, it's something like this. We want to be known fully and accepted completely. And it's elusive because we think, and a lot of times we're right, that if people knew this, they wouldn't accept me. And so we hide or we project or we do all these things to kind of get the acceptance we want because we're afraid of being known, and that leading to non-acceptance. I've said this before, but this is kind of one of my foundational verses describing relationships. This is Genesis 2:25, and if you want a story of how I was humiliated by this verse, you can ask me later. But this says, this describes the first human relationship, Adam and Eve, and it's described by saying, the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. And of course, that's literal, but it's also figurative, that they were naked before each other. They were fully known. And yet they accepted each other completely. And I think that's what we long for. And that's what God does. He knows us, and yet he still accepts us, and he still chooses to redeem us at great personal cost. And the way he does that is by initiating. He starts. He makes the first step. Remember, we're slaves. We have no choice. We have no value. We have no ability to free ourselves. That's the position that Paul describes us in. So God steps in and he makes that first step. He takes the first act to initiate relationship. And so that opens us up to God, and it means we can be freed and loved by him, but it also helps us to realize that relationship begins with initiation. Right? I mean, everybody you know, at some point, one of you said hi or looked awkward enough that the other person said hi or like something happened. Somebody initiated with somebody and the relationship comes out of that. Like, relationship can't happen without initiation. It has to start there. And so realizing how God initiated with us and the degree to which he initiated with us, I think helps us in community to realize it's all about initiation. It's all about taking that first step. And, you know, if you think it's hard to initiate with the person next to you, like, think of how hard it must have been for God to initiate with you. We're not all that, right? So, like, taking the first step can be the hard thing, but that's what relationships take. And that is the first indication. When you initiate with someone, that's the first indication of acceptance. It's the first hint to say, maybe this person wants to get to know me and will still accept me. That's what initiation means, right? I'd like to get to know you with the expectation that I will accept you once I get to know you. And so that's the foundation of how God treats us, but also becomes the foundation of how we respond to each other. So Paul says we started as slaves. That's his prior state. And then he describes this process of redemption, of God spending on us, of God initiating, of God expressing our value based on what he's willing to sacrifice. And the consequence, then, of this process is what Paul describes as adoption. He says, because of this, we are adopted as sons. And there's this beautiful, like, mixed metaphor that he says, we have been redeemed, and so you have in your head a slave market with a purchaser going and paying money to buy a slave, but we are redeemed into adoption as sons. And there's this, like, shift all of a sudden in the metaphor. So that you're not actually being purchased as a slave, you're being purchased as a son, and you are adopted by God. And that's remarkable. The idea that we are all sons of God, this is an elevated relationship. We are not just known by God. We are not just accepted. We are privileged. We are honored. We are given responsibilities and an inheritance. And so there's a very real sense in which everybody here is a son of God. And if you're a woman and you say, well, why do I have to be a son? You know, that's okay, because the men are also the bride of Christ. So, you know, it goes both ways. So they can try on their wedding dresses and you can, like, get the inheritance. And it's all, everybody wins, right? So there's this sense then that God adopts people as sons. And a lot of you know that I have two adopted children. And the one thing about the adoption that really struck me the most in the process, they were foster kids with us for a year and a half, and then we adopted them. And it's just this, like, it's one of those moments where, like, something incredible is happening, but it just feels normal. You know, like you walk into a courtroom and a judge says some things and you walk out and you have two new kids. Like, it's this, like, all I did was walk through a door and walk out, like, and say yes. And now I'm a parent again. Like, it's incredible. But one of the, like, things that really struck me is that after you adopt them and you fill out the paperwork, the state sent us a new birth certificate for my kids. And on that birth certificate are listed my name and my wife's name as the mother and father of our kids. And it's kind of like, it's so powerful, it feels weird, because it's like, if you just look at this document, there is no indication that there was ever a point in history when these two people were not my children. As far as the state is concerned, we are their parents, and we always have been. And somewhere in some locked vault is the original that can't be let out because it's no longer valid. But it's not like, there's not a separate line, like birth parents, adoptive parents, it's just mother, father. And that's who we are. And that's what their birth certificate says. And I just love that image that this is what God does to us. He takes us from being slaves, he redeems us, and he adopts us as sons. And he says that we are his. He is our father. And there's this great line, we cry out to him, Abba, Father. And if you have a good relationship with your father, if you have the type of father that you still call daddy and run to, then this is a beautiful picture. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't have a great relationship with their father. And sometimes this can be a hard image then, to think of God as your father. But it really is helpful in either way. If you, to the extent that your earthly father modeled God to you, then this is what God is. To the extent that your earthly father failed and didn't treat you well, God is the father you always wanted. He is the heavenly father that will love you and will take care of you and lead you and everything you've always wanted from your dad. And so this is the picture, that we become sons of God. But I think that Paul uses adoption intentionally, because adoption isn't just about relationship between a parent and child, right? So when we adopted our children, we already had 3 natural children by birth. And so when we adopted 2 children as parents, those 2 kids now had 3 new siblings. And they became part of a family. And so this adoption imagery is intentional to say you're not just adopted to be a child, but you're adopted into a family. And the best thing about family and the worst thing about family is you don't choose them, right? Your family is your family. And that's great because, like, in 15 years, I can call up my brother and he has no choice. He still has to be my brother, right? Even if I've done horrible things in the interim, like, he will be always be my brother. The terrible thing is in 15 years, my brother can call me up and I have to be his brother, right? I mean, I don't get to choose. Like, that relationship will always be there, for better or for worse. Because that's what family is. It means that you are brothers and sisters. We are brothers and sisters. And we've been talking about this group as a community, and we've observed that this is one of those places you come not because we all have the same interests or we all have the same personality types or we all like the same things, but we come because of one thing, and that is faith in Christ. That is what unites us. That is what creates this group into a unique group. And that's what makes us more than just part of a fellowship, but it makes us family in a way that is kind of almost beyond comprehension. It's so deep. And we don't get to choose it. We don't get to say, well, you know, this guy's my brother, I'll treat him like my brother, but that one, nah, you know. We're family. We are adopted into these relationships that we have with each other. So then Paul has described this process. We were slaves, we've been redeemed, we've become adopted. And then he has this last thing where he says, now that you have come to know God, or rather be known by God, how can you turn back again? And the sad thing about this is, even though you are a son of God, even though you are a brother and sister to each other, we can act like it's not so. We can turn back to living like slaves. We can be enslaved to rules. And we could turn into a community that's governed by rules and petty judgments and petty standards of how we should, you know, well, this person didn't do that, and so I'm not going to talk to them, or I'm not going to be their friend. We can live like that. That's available to us. We can be community, and we can choose to be enslaved by desires and just do what we want and not care about each other and kind of just go our own way and be selfish. And we can live like that. We can be enslaved that way. We don't have to live like the sons of God that we are. And so that's the warning. That's why Paul writes this letter, because we have a choice to realize who we are as individuals and as a community, and to live it out, to treat each other as brothers and sisters, and to understand ourselves as sons of God. And so that's this warning. You know, in the American South after the Civil War, when you know, we fought this big battle, and there was a moment then where all slaves were freed. And some of the American slaves kind of went on to try to live normal lives, and some of them said, I don't know what else to do with myself. And they went back to their masters and said, you know, I might be free, but I don't know how to be free. I don't know what that life looks like. So just let's just pretend I'm still a slave. And that's a tragedy, because as much as we want freedom, sometimes freedom is threatening. Truth is, it's easier to live by rules, right? Because we know what to do. We know if we're good. We know if we got an A or a B or a C. We can evaluate ourselves and we can walk away feeling like, all right, I followed the rules, I did the good stuff, I can feel good about myself. And it's easy to live by our desires because we just do what we want and we live our own way. Those choices are easier in some sense than real freedom. And so we're tempted to go back to them. We're tempted to live that way. Paul says don't. He says if you do that, you'll be giving up something really powerful, something really significant. You'll be giving up freedom. So this passage describes this process of change, and then it gives this warning to say, live this way, realize this, understand it for yourself, treat each other that way. And we are all kind of on that process in different ways. And this is just what it means to grow as a Christian, to grow in faith with Christ. A lot of it is realizing that we are sons of God. And that's just, you know, you go through different seasons where you don't feel like it and you feel guilt and shame and enslaved. And then you something happens and you feel freed up. And it starts with understanding how God has loved us and reached out to us. And a lot of times we're in different places with understanding. And well, what does that mean in these relationships, in those relationships? And how do I treat people as brothers and sisters? And we're all kind of somewhere jumbled up trying to figure all this out. And that's what God does. He uses a community to teach us. And the great thing about that is we don't have to feel like we have to get it right. We have to be here or else we're failing. This is a process. This is what spiritual growth is all about. So we should expect then, as a community and as individuals, that we're going to get it wrong. And we're going to go to one extreme or go to the other extreme or hurt each other or have hurt feelings ourselves. And we're going to have to go to God in prayer and figure out what this means. We're going to have to go back to the scriptures and realize how we're valued by God. We're going to have to ask people, why did this affect you that way? How did I hurt you? We're going to have to listen to each other and ask for forgiveness and tell somebody that we were hurt by them. Like, this is what it is. This is what the Christian life is all about. It's about figuring this stuff out in understanding it and in living it out. And so there's a great freedom in that, to feel like we're just trying to make it work. We don't have to have it right. We're not going to get it right. But this is what it's all about, being together and doing that. And so I want to encourage us with that, that we don't have to feel like, oh man, you know, this is awful. I hurt somebody's feelings, or I got hurt and I don't know what to do about it. And it's just terrible. You know, we slip back. Like, that's part of it. That's part of how we grow, is by going through that together and by walking alongside each other in that.